At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Today on The Grave Talks, Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society. With over 25 years dedicated to exploring the supernatural, be it ghosts, aliens, or cryptids, the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society shares their insights in their new book. You can discover how they methodically dissect claims, seeking rational explanations for the unexplained. Each case in the book brings you eerie stories and a deep dive into the investigations, uncovering the history, the claims, and the paranormal investigations. So whether you crave a chilling ghost story, have a keen interest in paranormal investigations, or you consider yourself a seasoned investigator, you'll love this book. Today on The Grave Talks, Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society, a conversation with paranormal investigators and authors Robert Lewis and Brian Bonner. Brian and Bob, thank you so much for being on The Grave Talks today, and a big congratulations on the book. It's Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society, Volume 1.
Yep, and Volume 1 of many more to come.
That was going to be my question. Brian, you started the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Group 25 years ago?
25 years ago, yeah, it seems like a long time. Actually, we're just short. We're about 2 months shy of 25 years, but close enough for me. We've been doing it for a long time, and hopefully we're just getting started.
How many people do you have in your on your team?
We try to keep the group small, and you know, we may go into this in a bit, but a lot of people, when they're doing investigations, kind of do it for fun more than they do for actually investigating. But if you're trying to legitimately figure things out, you really need to have control of the situation. And the more people you have, the harder it is to control what's going on and what you see and what you hear. And because of that, we keep a small crew. We, you know, three or four people at an investigation is kind of an average, unless we need assistance from different types of professionals. We may want to get involved, and at that point, it'll expand.
Or occasionally there's a large place that we just have a lot of ground to cover. We might bring in a few more people for something like that. But yeah, as Brian was saying, a pretty small crew usually.
Because when I was reading the book, the Stanley Hotel, you have a whole chapter on that hotel and investigating it. That to me seems like you would need a team of like 50 people to go in. But I also get how you would lose control, maybe not lose control, but it would be hard to do with that many people.
Well, what I would recommend, Bob has a good story about an audio recording that we acquired from another group that I think explains how you can lose control.
Yeah, that we a different group had preceded us to a case at a private residence, and they left one of their audio recordings. And so I was listening to it just to see what they had captured. And what I discovered was the various crew members on their team just kept talking and kept making noise and running around and basically contaminating their own data, to the point that a ghost could have walked right up to the microphone and started reciting Shakespearean sonnets, and nobody could tell because the investigators never shut up long enough for anyone to record anything.
Now, to me, I am not on a paranormal investigation team, but that almost seems like 101, one of the first things you would learn in the training. You know what I mean? That you can't go around talking, that you have to, it just, because you could be, you know, in your own investigation and like, oh, look, this is paranormal. Oh, no, it's just Bob Lewis over there talking.
Well, I think that
exactly.
Yeah, what you're really discussing is kind of the two different takes on how people do this. They get into it because they're they know that places are haunted and they're there to prove it to the rest of the world, or, you know, lots of different reasons like that. But they do it for fun. They do it for, you know, it's just going to be a good night out, which it can be, but kind of like there's we always...
There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, and exactly. We have fun too, but on top of that, we're also trying to do a serious, scholarly sort of investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with going out and playing. It's definitely fun, but sometimes you've got to dial it back a little bit just to be able to get an investigation done.
And don't you think, too, with the popularity, because you've been doing this a long time, and, you know, 25 years ago, I don't know if there was really any ghost hunter type shows on TV. You know, we had Unsolved Mysteries.
Not so much on TV. There were a few people. It was sort of starting then. There were a few people starting to get interested in that sort of thing. But
yeah, when we felt like it is now, we were one of three groups in the area. And about 7 or 8 years ago, we were involved in a national poll, and it turned out in Colorado by itself, there were several hundred groups.
Oh, my gosh. So the popularity
has increased. And I mean, admittedly, when we first started, one of the things I did because I was interested in it was whenever there was a paranormal something on television, I'd record it off of TV. And it was generally around the Halloween season, and then it was dry the entire time. Now, if you were to do that, you would run out of recording media because it's just nonstop all the time.
And don't you think, too, that with the TV shows, that might pique someone's curiosity and they think, I want to start a team, and they do, and they expect it to be more like what it's like on TV with a lot of, because that's all edited, too. So even if some of the findings are legit, it's edited to make it look like it's super action-packed, whereas you might go into a location and sit there all night and pick up nothing.
Exactly.
That's pretty common.
Yeah.
Just a couple of days ago, we were at a location and sat all night and nothing happened.
Yeah, kind of what you were talking about, what I relate it to is... It's just like somebody watching a medical drama on TV and saying, oh, I'm going to be a doctor and go out and do that without any training, without any idea what they're doing. And in order to do this, you really need to have some basic concepts of what you're doing and how you're doing it. And strangely enough, watching television really isn't the best way to learn how to do it.
Could be a good inspiration, but it's not going to give you the technical expertise that you know. Even to just know how to operate the equipment that you're using properly and be able to account for anomalous recordings or whatever.
That's what I really appreciated about the book. And I think anyone who's interested in doing paranormal investigations, the book is so interesting to me because you really do explain why you're doing what you're doing, what tools you used on the investigation, what you found on the investigation, stories that you've been told. And I just think it's so interesting that I just think it would be a great read for someone who wants to just read about ghost stories because it's full of those. But it's also just so interesting what you have to do them. So I think people could get a good idea of what it really is like outside of watching someone investigate on TV.
I would certainly hope so. That's sort of one of our goals with the book was to not to put anyone down, but there's a lot of bad information out there. And some of it's not intentionally bad information. It's just television shows being television shows. But a lot of people get the wrong ideas of what this is really like. So one of our goals with the book was to sort of provide the more realistic, level-headed, not jumping to conclusions in either direction sort of perspective on it.
You know, I talked to someone recently and he said he's done paranormal investigations. I think he said 20 plus years. And he said that more often than not, he finds they need a good electrician or a plumber or something because there's, you know, their house is making noises, but it's not paranormal.
We find a lot of those.
I would think that would be really good information for somebody who thinks their house is haunted to find out. I hate to tell you this, you're going to have to spend $20,000 or something on the plumbing, but it's not.
Sometimes it's not even that bad. We had one that's actually in the book. it was just a leaky flapper valve on their toilet. So, you know, go down to the big blue or orange home center, spend $15 in half an hour, and you can make your ghost go away.
Which I would hope they really appreciated that.
Unless they actually did. They really did in that case. Some people get angry because they really want it to be the ghost, but they just wanted to know what was happening. So they were, I think, relieved that they didn't need to be afraid of their house. We were able to tell them, okay, you know, fasten this pipe down, replace this valve, and you'll be fine.
Because I do think that sometimes, you know, a bat can be in your attic, a raccoon can get up there, and it can totally sound paranormal.
Oh, yeah.
But doesn't mean that it is. And one thing I always talk about on this show, that especially when I'm talking about a location that has paranormal activity, I just think that the history sets it up. I think really to fully understand it, you need to look into the history of the location, look into the history, and that helps explain the hauntings or possible hauntings. And one thing that you said in the book, that history provides the context for why things are the way they are. And I really appreciated that. I thought that was a good way to say that about how you guys dive into the history. How important is that? And I'll start with you, Brian. How important is that for you to know the history of a building before you go in there? How much information do you want?
As much as we can possibly get. The thing is, with private investigations, like at somebody's home, there may not be as much history to the location, but it's still important because you may have previous residents or neighbors or, you know, friends that have witnessed things happening or know something that happened in the history of the building that, you know, we can start putting things together and try and figure out what it is. I've said it many times before, a lot of them, I don't even care if there's a ghost story. The history is so interesting that it's a story all by itself.
I'm a history buff. So to me, even just learning the history of when something was built, who, like the in the book about, for example, the Stanley Hotel, I had no idea. That had such a long history. You know, it wasn't just this guy built it. It was much deeper than that. And I would just think with paranormal investigations, those would go hand in hand. You would want to know all that.
Yeah, it really should. And it's for that context, like we were talking about a moment ago. But like you, I'm a history nerd, so I'd be interested in the stuff anyway. But even if you don't start as a history nerd, if you want to do this work, you really need to sort of become a de facto historian because you need that history. And it turns out, ghost stories or not, and I love the ghost stories, the history is fascinating. You mentioned the Stanley Hotel. Mr. Stanley didn't just build the hotel. He damn near built the entire city of Estes Park.
What I found interesting about that place in particular was there seems to be so many reports of spirits. And do they keep track of that or do they keep a catalog? I've talked to some hotels that do that. If they get a guest who says they have a paranormal experience, they write it down in a book.
I don't know if they have a book, but they certainly have a lot of stories and they have tour guides to repeat the stories.
Yeah, we've actually been to places, hotels that did exactly what you're saying. There's a book in the lobby, and if you've had a ghost story, go write it down.
Which I think is really cool. There's a hotel in Lawrence, Kansas, the Eldridge Hotel, and they do that. And I think it'd be fun just to look through that book. I think there was one part in there, it's cigar smoke. No, it's a guy cooking bacon or something like that.
But, yeah, that was one of them.
But it does seem like it would be hard too if you had access to all the stories. It would be so overwhelming. Where do you even start with what's fact and what's fiction, what's debunkable, what really happened?
Where we usually start is, and it varies from case to case. It kind of just depends on whatever we can look into. But we would start with claims that seem to be testable or possibly observable for whatever reason. So maybe things that are repetitive, things that are thought to happen on a certain schedule or at least recur. Because if something happened 20 years ago, it's a great story, but there's nothing we can do. We just file that away as a story. But on the other hand, if your claim is a book flies off the shelf every Thursday at 2 o'clock, then we can be there at Thursday at 2 o'clock and see what we can see.
Have you like had that happen? Well, it's 2 o'clock. Oh, dang, there goes the book.
Very rarely would it be that specific, but at least a lot of times they'll say, when we're going to bed, frequently something happens. Then we can pick a couple of evenings and try to be there at that time. And
yeah, because you would want to know what time of day is something happening. And you know, because when I was a kid, we lived in a haunted house. I couldn't tell you that this man walked out of the upstairs bathroom every night and walked down the stairs. He did it a lot of nights. And there was things that happened during the day, but not those footsteps that you would hear at night. It was definitely recurring when that particular thing happened. The book is in three sections.
Yes.
So one of them is more the public type of places that you could go. And then there's private residences. Then the third one was a little bit, I don't know how to describe that.
More like just sort of miscellaneous experiments and media analysis and just sort of other stuff that didn't fit into the other two.
Do you find it's harder to investigate a public place or a private place, or it just depends location to location?
The approach is always definitely catered to wherever it is that we are. But I think because we've got the experience and the critical thinking ability, as long as we set up a plan, I don't think anything's harder or easier than any other. They're just wildly different.
And with the...
I would add that I think a couple actually do get a little bit harder. For example, there's one that's not in this book yet. It'll be in one of the future volumes. But there was one that was in an active casino. We had a room to ourselves down in the basement, but it's a lot harder to control circumstances when there's that much activity going on. So a few do present an extra challenge, but I don't think it's between public or private. I think it's just case by case. Every once in a while, one is just a challenge.
And I would think with a private residence, because I have talked to other investigators, that, you know, you do have to screen the family, not to just jump to mental health issues, but you do have to understand if they're stable people.
Well, and if it's a large location with historic type claims, you may have the occasional witness, but at that point you really have to see if you can document or figure out what the claim is itself without having the interaction with the people.
So if you go into a private residence, do you prefer they leave? Or
normally what we do is we will go in, interview them, see what exactly it is that's going on. We've already talked to them before, but maybe there's something new. Determine some places to set up our equipment, set it up, and then we kind of hide in the corner. We'll find an empty room, basement, something, and put ourselves there and tell the family, go about whatever it is that you do on a, you know, a normal day, because we want everything to stay the same. That's when whatever it is that they're reporting happens. So we want it to be the same. So if they're causing something to happen, you know, just it's more likely that we're going to witness something if the conditions are the same.
Or as close to the same as we can get them. There's always that challenge in any kind of field research, but we try to mimic normal conditions we go to great lengths to mimic those conditions as much as possible.
Have you been in a place that, you know, you might have thought, we're going to go check them out, indulge them, and then really been surprised?
You know, it's one of those things. It's kind of like if you've gone to, you know, a bunch of different places and nothing happens, you start to get really disbelieving. But then it's just, you know, one thing. You go to a location and just one little tiny thing happens, and it brings it right back to, oh yeah, there might be something. I need to keep looking into this. So it's not even the ones that you do or don't expect something to happen. It's more of the mindset you have because of what you've witnessed or not witnessed over the past several investigations.
See, I don't know. I think you guys are brave and maybe a little crazy for doing what you do, because I just can't bring myself to do anything like that. I think I would be making stuff up in my head all night long. Oh, did you hear that? Did you hear that? How that, are you that, able to separate?
That does happen, for yeah. sure. And that's something we have to sort of psychologically always guard against or account for. If something weird happens, was it just our minds playing tricks on us because we're sleep deprived and we've been telling ghost stories all day, or did something really happen? And I'm going to let Brian tell a story. It's one of the ones from the book, but it's a good illustration of exactly that.
Oh, you must be talking about your favorite illustration.
Yes, I am. there's an artist we had do illustrations for the book, and he illustrated this chapter in such a way that I want to frame that and put it on my wall for reasons that will become clear as Brian finishes the story.
So we got called into this place, and it was a private residence, and basically there was one room in the home that was claimed to be the most haunted, and for some reason that's where the whole family decided to sleep. Everybody had gone to one room, so it was a very packed room full of people sleeping. But we went to do our investigation there, and we noticed after a while that nobody had gone to bed. It's the middle of the night, and I'm like, so wouldn't you guys normally be asleep by now? And they said, well, we're kind of afraid to go in there. And I said, it's okay, we can watch. We've got cameras set up. We've got audio in there. Anything happens, we will know about it. So one pair of people went in and they slept. And then they came out after a couple of hours. And I said, okay, who's next? And two more of them said, yeah, we'll go ahead and go in. And then they looked at me and said, but we're not going to go in unless you go in with us. To which I said, you know, if something big, green, and scary jumps out of the closet, I'm probably going to run with you, but we'll give it a shot. And we went in there, and after a while, they had fallen asleep. I was sitting at the foot of the bed, and there's a lot of things to report at this house, but the big one was it felt as if something was starting to slap me in the face. Very gently, but enough to, you know, kind of the, hey, I'm here. The only thing you can see on the video is me going, I hope you guys are getting something because it feels like something's in here slapping me. Nothing on the video. And I can say I honestly felt that. But kind of like Bob was alluding to, I'd been up for pushing 40 hours straight. I had been eating junk food for the majority of the time, and I had spent most of the day sitting with this family telling me ghost stories about this specific room, and now I've just locked myself in the dark there. You couldn't set yourself up psychologically worse if you had to.
Right.
So could it have been my imagination playing with me because of all of these horrible conditions I put myself in? That's definitely a possibility.
So looking back on that, is that what you feel? Or do you really feel like something slapped me when I was in there?
I would say definitely maybe. I don't know. I mean, I could sway either way, but at the same time, I have that logical side that says I don't know, so I can't jump to any specific conclusion. I'd love to say it's a ghost, but it's just as likely that it was a bad bit of food, as they say.
Unfortunately, in that situation, we have to just sort of leave it as a question mark in our ledgers, because without some sort of physical evidence or video documentation or independent witnesses, it's just impossible to tell a ghost from a trick of the brain.
Did any of your evidence that you gathered that night support the possibility of it? Did you see some other things or hear some other things when you reviewed it?
Not right at that moment. There were a couple other things. There was a sound of scratching from the wall, which was unusual because it was a foundation wall, so there probably shouldn't have been mice or something scratching behind the wall. But it's another one where we weren't able to figure out what it was, but we're not able to say for sure that's a ghost or for sure that's mice or for sure that's, you know, a trick of the brain or whatever the case.
And I think it's interesting when you do an investigation of a private residence and they tell you that they're having all these experiences, you go in and you do an investigation and you don't really come out with anything. How do people handle that? Because it doesn't answer their questions. And I think in their minds, they probably are like, they're going to come in here and lay it all out for us.
Well, it really depends on the what the claims are and what the mindset of the people is. If they're truly afraid of something in their house, regardless of if we find something or we don't find something, we will work with them and get them to counseling, because we'll tell them if it's real or not, it's affecting you, it's affecting mm-hmm. your life, mm-hmm. it's affecting your family. It would help to have somebody to talk to about this. And at that point, we'll work with whoever it is. We'll find a psychologist. We'll find a member of their clergy, whatever it is, somebody they feel comfortable in talking to. And then we'll tell them, you know, there's a couple of ways that this turns out. Just because nothing happened when we were there doesn't mean nothing always happens. It right. just means we happen to be there when nothing happened. And just because, let's say something does happen, I feel like I get slapped. Just because there's something that we can't explain that has been documented one way or the other, it doesn't immediately make it paranormal in nature. You can't just jump to that conclusion.
Right.
It's just working with the people and, you know, kind of helping them cope with it. And if they're comfortable with it, you know, one thing that people really seem to deal with pretty well is to say, okay, as long as this isn't freaking you out, not everybody gets to witness this kind of a thing in their life. And how cool is it that you did? Even if it wasn't real and you feel that it was real, enjoy it, because not everybody gets that.
Right. Well, and there was one story in here. I can't remember the name of the chapter, but it was, and these are not their real names, Alice and Billy.
I'm trying to remember which chapter that was, because I changed everybody's names and I'm
just, so I'm it was something about a
going through
demon.
The book to find out.
So they lived in the house for quite a while. This is in the private investigations section, but they'd lived in the house for quite a while. She was a single mom. I think her son was in the 8-year-old range, and he was seeing someone. She saw someone, and then they wanted you to come in, but I don't really think she wanted an investigation necessarily.
We get that a lot too. Some people are, and I'm going to say this a little differently than I normally would. A lot of the people that call us are addicted to paranormal television. Mm. And a lot of them are very comfortable with what they believe is a haunting, and they'll almost treat it as a pet. So it's like, you know, I just want somebody to come in and confirm this for me. Don't get rid of it, because we really like it. So if we're to go in and say, you know, we just found a pipe that was shaking in the basement, they don't take well to that.
This was Smudging the Demon. That was the chapter.
Oh,
I just had to.
Yeah, I know the one they talked.
And what happened in that one was they didn't really want an investigation at all. They wanted somebody to perform a cleansing or get rid of this thing, which is not a service that we provide. But in that case, we determined that's sort of what they needed. So we arranged for somebody to come in. They performed basically a cleansing of the house. And after that, their paranormal claims stopped. And it leaves us with two possibilities. One of which is it was a placebo effect and they expected this ritual to help, and so it helped. And the other is maybe there was something actually there and this ritual made it go away. We might have private suspicions one way or the other, but we always have to sort of maintain that neutrality. In the absence of evidence, it could go either way.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point there. Something that I think a lot of other people in the field don't take into consideration is you really have to respect the beliefs of the people at the location. Mm-hmm. You are a believer, a non-believer, a believer of a different variety than the people's house that you're going to. You need to leave that aside and talk to them based on their own belief system, which means you get to do a lot of research on world religions.
I bet. Right.
Yeah, it's really important because in the case of this case we were talking about, they were sort of a pagan or neo-pagan sort of a belief system. It wouldn't really do to bring a Catholic priest in to perform an exorcism for these people. But on the other hand, if you're dealing with a Catholic family, it wouldn't deal to bring in the pagan practitioner.
Because I hadn't really thought of it like that. I would think a blessing like a priest will come in and do that. But you're right. You would have to align that with their belief system.
If we could somehow prove one way or the other which religion was right, that may not be good for social harmony, but we would say so, and we might start using that sort of practice. But in the absence of that proof, we really need to respect whoever's brought us in.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation about Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society, Volume 1, with authors Robert Lewis and Brian Bonner. You can buy the book at polymathpress.com, Amazon, or wherever books are sold. And for more information, you can visit their website at rockymountainparanormal.com or find them on Facebook. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, you'll get everything commercial free. Become a Gravekeeper. You can sign up on Apple Podcasts. You can also sign up on patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.